Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Press TV Spotlight. The Russian Defense Ministry says the recent U.S. military actions in the Black Sea are aggressive and pose a threat to regional and strategic stability. The ministry said it had detected six NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea in the past 24 hours, stressing that Russia will act to defend its security if there is any threatening action by its opponents along its borders. Government spokesman Dmitry Peskov dismissed a Western media report on the U.S.'s concerns about Russia's possible attack on Ukraine. Well, the Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which rejoined Russia in a 2014 referendum. NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have our correspondent Marina Kortsunova, who's with us from the Russian capital, Moscow, with more on the recent tensions. Marina, very briefly, if you may bring us up to speed, please.
Good evening. Russia views the U.S. military activity in the Black Sea region as a security threat, of course. And so last 2 days, in the U.S. forces are holding unscheduled activities and created a multinational group of armed forces in close proximity to the Russian border. So the ministry said the actions, Ministry of Defense said the actions were a destabilizing factor for the region and are aimed at the military development of the Ukrainian territory. NATO warship activity in the Black Sea is a matter of concern for Russian President Putin as well, and the reason for heightened precautions. As Russia's defense ministry stressed, the true goal of the U.S. actions unprovoked by Russia are to study the threat of military operations in case of the use of force scenario in the southeast. So Russian radars spotted and tracked six NATO reconnaissance planes over the Black Sea in the past 24 hours, specifically in the central and northwestern parts of the Black Sea. The Russian radar systems detected air reconnaissance flights by three U.S. Navy Poseidon maritime patrol planes from the U.S. air base on Sicily, French Air Force Gabriel reconnaissance aircraft from the air base in Romania, a U.S. Air Force strategic reconnaissance plane from the air base on the island of Crete, and also a U.S. strategic reconnaissance aircraft from the Cyprus air base. In addition, the U.S. Navy guided missile destroyer Porter, the command ship Mount Whitney, and the tanker John Lampel are deployed in the southwestern part of the Black Sea after completing their transit from the Georgian port of Batumi and continue moving westward, as the ministry said. So the Black Sea, as from Russian side, in the Black Sea fleet's ships are the missile cruiser Moskva, the frigate Admiral Essen, and the patrol vessel Pavel Derzhavin are closely watching the U.S. warships there. So, in general, as Russian experts said, the Americans left Afghanistan in order to sway the situation around Ukraine and in the Black Sea. Less than 2 months have passed since it all began by Russian borders. So, Russian Federation has been hearing endless reports of the Western media as well about U.S. fears about the possible invasion of Russia into Ukraine, into Baltic countries, the seizure of world domination, etc., for an endless number of years. Therefore, I will not even cite here a comment by Dmitry Peskov, Vladimir Putin's press secretary Sergei Lavrov, and others that Russia does not pose a threat to any country. Everyone knows who is the real threat is. This is the United States and its satellites, which destroyed the Middle East. By the way, it's very important that Russia has already been declared the culprit of the migrant crisis on the border of Poland and Belarus recently. Maybe Russian intelligence planes should infuriate the United States somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico under their noses. Is it a pity that Russia does not allow this? What do you think?
All right, thanks a lot. That was our correspondent Marina Kortsunova joining us from Moscow. Also joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have spokesman of LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, who's joining us from Potsdam, Germany. And we've also got Senior Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, who's joining us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, to start off with Mr. Schlanger in Potsdam, sir, welcome to Press TV Spotlight. Russia's defense ministry has accused the U.S. military of aggressive activity in the Black Sea region and that these actions pose a threat to regional and strategic stability. Moscow also says it will defend its security against any threats. Talk to us about these recent tensions and what kind of message is Russia trying to send here?
Well, I think the main message is coming from the United States, which is that it's now pressing the situation in Ukraine. It's pressing the situation in the South China Sea. As your correspondent from Moscow pointed out, much of this has happened after the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the so-called pivot to Asia to contain China, and the escalation against Russia. One other statement from a Russian military spokesman that's quite significant: the Russians are being accused of massing troops on the Ukrainian border. And what he said is actually they're monitoring the escalated actions of NATO in the Black Sea and in near Russian airspace. The question here is, what's the goal of the United States? Secretary of State Blinken was in Ukraine recently, just a couple days ago, met with the foreign minister, and they signed a security agreement, agreement which basically said that they're blaming Russia for the conflict in eastern Ukraine. They're saying that Russia is taking substantive measures for aggression against Ukraine, and also Crimea must be returned. These are all provoking what Vladimir Putin described as red lines for Russia, especially the Crimea. And in terms of this recent confrontation, or the recent escalation, go back to June 24th when the HMS Defender, a British destroyer, entered into Russian territorial waters and had to be chased away by shots fired across its bow. At that time, it became clear that NATO was going to escalate the pressure on Russia using Ukraine as an issue. So I think what the Russians are saying is, look, we're not going to be pushed around. We have our defense perimeter. We have our own interests. But we don't want to have a war. And it's clear that the war initiative is coming from the war hawks in the West.
Mr. George Samueli in Budapest, Russia says that it detected six NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea just in the past 24 hours. In your opinion, what is the point of these activities?
That's a very good question. Clearly, these activities are directed at intimidating Russia, at persuading the Western public that Russia, on the contrary, is the threatening power, is the aggressor power. As my colleague just pointed out, this comes 2 days after the belligerent statement issued by the Ukraine Foreign Minister and Secretary of State Blinken, in which they announced a strategic partnership in which the entire conflict going on in Ukraine is blamed on Russia. and there's nothing there about the Minsk Accords, which the United States, at least in public, declares it's committed to, and which, of course, Ukraine has done nothing whatever to implement. Why I say this is very strange, because at this very moment, the Western powers are desperately trying to get Russia, and President Putin in particular, to help them out of various problems that incompetent Western leadership has led the West to. I'm thinking now about the crisis on the Poland-Belarus border with the migrants. So we've now had Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, twice, in I think 2 days, calling President Putin, saying, please, please, please help us out, even though this is clearly a mess of the EU's making. I mean, the EU has neither provided its eastern member states with any kind of security against migrants, and they, you know, they've refused to provide any sort of funds to build a wall. And at the same time, they're refusing to talk to President Lukashenko in trying to work something out with him, because they find Lukashenko is too horrible a person to deal with, even though when it comes to Erdogan, they have no problems dealing with Erdogan and paying him off in order to prevent migrants coming from Turkey. So they're asking Putin to help us out. Please, please, please help us out. And the same goes with the energy problems. Again, many reasons why Europe is having an energy crisis. But again, in large part, it's very bad EU leadership. And so they're going to Putin, please, please, please help us out. Get the energy, get the gas flowing, so that we, you know, we're not going to freeze this winter. So they're doing this at the very same time that they're antagonizing Russia in the Black Sea. And the Russians keep saying that, you know, you're holding these exercises, you're clearly testing our air defenses in the Black Sea. And why do you test air defenses? Then in some ways you are planning some kind of military action. This obviously, you know, the Russians find very troubling. And this on top of all of the commentary on Ukraine, you know, the hysteria in the Western media about Russia is about to invade Ukraine. Sure. So all of this, you know, this belligerence towards Russia at the time when the Western powers want Russia's help on these important issues is indeed bizarre.
Mr. Schlanger, many are believing, many observers are believing that the United States, the likes of the United States and Britain, they may be trying to incite conflict in the Black Sea. In your opinion, if that's the case, what kind of repercussions would there be from any further standoffs in the Black Sea, not just regionally, but maybe even globally?
Well, first of all, it's a sort of shooting with blanks. The military capability of the West now vis-a-vis Russia is compromised. We just saw the United States couldn't hold the ground in Afghanistan in a 20-year war. The U.S. military has very few real options short of full-scale nuclear war. Now, we see this in terms of what's happening with the Belarus situation. I just want to make a point about that. One of the things Putin said to Merkel is that if you're worried about the refugee crisis, stop these wars which produce refugees, referring to the endless wars from the West, and secondly, stop the sanctions. The sanctions against countries such as Yemen, the Caesar sanctions against Syria, against Afghanistan, and against Iran, actually worsen the situation and increase the migration. So it's clear that the problem is coming from the West, but the question is, what is their end game? What do they intend? Their ultimate goal is regime change against President Putin, and that's been clear for a long time. But I don't think they have the capability to do it. Putin is not a Ukrainian leader. He's a very strong figure who's actually done he's actually stopped wars repeatedly that have been instigated from the West, for example, in Syria. So the whole Western strategy is a bluff game to try to force Russia and China to adhere to what Blinken calls a rules-based order. And this, these rules-based order is outside of the United Nations. It's outside of agreed-upon international law. It's a dictate coming especially from the financial institutions of the West against Russia and China, who won't go along with the policies that are being pushed. Now, I just want to add one thing. The Schiller Institute, which I work with, is having a conference this weekend, which will include people speaking from Russia, from China, from throughout the Middle East, to take up the question of what is the pathway toward peace and cooperation. It's worth noting that YouTube has just shut down the Schiller Institute website to keep this conference from getting live streamed. So all the talk about the authoritarian attacks on free press in Russia, Iran, elsewhere, in fact, it's the U.S. that is practicing these kinds of authoritarian measures.
Mr. Samueli, the Kremlin has defended its military presence in the region, arguing it's entitled to move its troops within its territory. Washington has accused Russia of aggressive expansionism. Many would say it's the other way around, as the U.S. has been trying to expand NATO to surround Russia. How is it aggressive for Moscow to mobilize troops in their own borders, but not NATO, but not a NATO expansion?
Well, of course, it isn't. Russia doesn't move its troops outside of its borders, whereas the NATO powers move all the time up to Russia's borders. So we have now recently a letter written by these Republican congressmen, something 15 Republican congressmen, demanding that President Biden station permanently American forces in Ukraine. The question, this person was on television the other day, and he was asked, well, isn't this provocative? Isn't this likely to involve America possibly in a shooting war with Russia? So, no, this is all deterrence. This is the myopic view of Western political and military leaders. They just simply think, well, we can move our forces right up to Russia's borders. We can have our warships sailing around in the Black Sea all the way up to Russia's territorial waters, and that's all peaceful. That's just simply deterrence. That's not in any way threatening anyone's security. Well, of course, it's nonsensical. Russia is a Black Sea power. It always has been. And therefore, for NATO to fantasize that they can somehow prevent Russia from being a Black Sea power is ridiculous. But this is really, what's going on here, which is that somehow the West imagines that as long as if they can just keep huffing and puffing and conducting these exercises, getting close to Russian airspace, Russia will just simply go away. That Putin will disappear and all of the West problems will disappear. It won't. And all it has done, all this NATO expansion, these I think aggressive military exercises close to Russia's frontiers, all it has done is that it has brought Russia and China ever closer together. And so while we now have the Biden administration ostensibly saying, well, China is really the big problem, that's our headache for the next generation, well, they've now got a much bigger headache because there's really no daylight between Russia and China. And that's entirely as a result of Western actions toward Russia.
Mr. Samueli, the increasing tensions right now certainly has something to do with a dip in U.S.-Russia relations. Whenever there are tensions between Russia and NATO, you have to look further to the West, meaning the United States. We have to look at what the Biden administration is bringing to the table. And so far, it's been trying to pressure Moscow. Now, if Washington's method is to further antagonize Russia, in your opinion, how will that feed into NATO?
Well, the U.S. position, to the extent that one can understand the U.S. position, is that they can somehow want the Europeans in NATO to take care of Russia, to contain Russia, while the United States moves further afield to try to contain China. So that's the kind of division of labor as Washington envisages. The problem is that the Europeans have been rather feckless. They kind of know that they are being pushed into a confrontation with Russia, which they don't want. But they've, for all, you know, Macron having talked about NATO being brain dead, the Europeans haven't really stood up to the Americans, and they tend to go along with it. But, and so we had a serious crisis that took place earlier this year in the spring, when you know, American belligerence in Ukraine, and even threats of sending American warships into the Black Sea, it seemed that they were going to provoke a major confrontation with Russia. And so France and Germany absolutely panicked, and they got on the phone to Putin and tried to work something out. And above all, they got on the phone to Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, and said, hey, call off your offensive in the southeast of Ukraine, because there's a real chance that you know, the Russians will step in if you mount an offensive against Russian nationals living in Ukraine. So the way is that this American belligerence leads to the Europeans getting pushed into a confrontation with Russia that they really deeply don't want. And you know, unfortunately, you know, when they only right in the last minute do they kind of, you know, step in and say, hey, there's something badly going on here, we need to bring this to an end.
Mr. Schlanger, we lost the connection for a second there. Apparently, he's back with us on the line from Potsdam, Germany. We'll get a final thought from him before we wrap up the show. Mr. Schlanger, Ukraine has accused Russia of systemic aggravation of the security situation in Donbass and Crimea. Also, a NATO official claimed Moscow is undermining peace efforts in the rest of the Ukrainian region. The question is Russia really the threat that NATO says it is?
No, Russia is not a threat. Threat coming from NATO. Keep in mind, where did this regime come from that's now in power in Ukraine? It was a coup. It was a coup that was run in part by Joe Biden, who was coordinating on the scene through NATO, working with right-wing networks in Ukraine, and mobilized to essentially deal a blow to Russia. This is after they had attempted to bring Georgia into NATO. This is their policy. As our colleague from Budapest was saying, the expansion of NATO is the Western policy. And so they're creating this myth of a Russian enemy image. This is necessary for the military-industrial complex to be able to demand close to $1 trillion a year in the U.S. defense budget. And, you know, I would say the corruption is on the U.S. side. We're fighting to get Americans to understand that we have no interest, no legitimate national interest in a war with Russia. In fact, the reason we ended up pulling out, the United States ended up pulling out of Afghanistan, was because the American people were tired of these kinds of wars. The message obviously hasn't been heard yet in Washington.
All right, unfortunately, we're running short of time for this segment of the program. Allow me to thank my guest, spokesman at LaRouche Organization, Harmy Schlanger, joining us right now on the line from Potsdam, Germany. And thanks to a senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, who's with us from Budapest. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَمَنْ خَفَّتْ مَوَازِينُهُ فَأُولَئِكَ الَّذِينَ خَسِرُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ فِي جَهَنَّمَ خَالِدُونَ.
But those whose scales are light, those are the ones who have lost their souls, being in hell, abiding eternally.
تلفح وجوههم النار وهم فيها كالحون.
The fire will sear their faces, and they therein will have taut smiles.
The 104th verse of the chapter starts saying, تلفح وجوههم النار وهم فيها كالحون. The fire will burn their faces, and they are glum therein, with their lips displaced. So, this verse is talking about the people who have not used this world as means of reaching prosperity, and they have their scales light, so they will abide in hell. So, it says, the fire will burn their faces. The fire burns the faces of the inhabitants of the hell continuously and without any respite. So, the unbelievers are suffering physically, تَلْفَحُ وُجُوهَهُمُ النَّارِ, and also spiritually, وَهُمْ فِيهَا كَالِحُونَ, and they are glum therein with their lips displaced. They are also suffering spiritually in their painful punishment, and the verse only is mentioning one part of it. The word تَلْفَحُ is derived from the word لَفْح, which originally means the blow of a sword. Since the effect of a flame or the intense light of the sun, when they hit the human face, is like that of a sword, this word is used as an allusion to this meaning. So تَلْفَحُ وُجُوهَهُمُ النَّارِ means the fire is burning their faces away. Something like cutting their faces. وَهُمْ فِيهَا كَالِحُونَ. The word كَالِح is derived from the word كُلُح, which means to become grim-faced. Many commentators have interpreted the word in this way, because when the skin of the face feels the heat of the fire, it becomes somehow contorted in such a way that the lips would remain open.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Now, we have already mentioned that the divine punishment in hereafter, and even in this world, proportionately reflects the sins committed. It is not such that any kind of punishment would be inflicted upon any kind of wrongdoer. In this verse, the burning inflicted upon faces by flames of hell will be so severe that these faces will be contorted and their lips will peel back. And this is a punishment for those whose scales are light and they are unbelievers. They did not believe in the existence of such a day. They made the most of the world, but they made the most of it in their own way. Because they thought there is no resurrection, there is no day of judgment, they did their best in wrongdoing. Now, when we reflect that most of them are the ones who turned their faces and ears away when they hear the divine verses recited to them, and who sometimes smiled in mockery at them, the proportionality of this punishment to their deeds becomes evident. The blessings that the Almighty Allah had provided them with, the ears, the eyes, the mouth, the lips, and everything, they were all misused. And this is what awaits them in the day of resurrection. But those who are righteous and love Allah are vastly different to those whose balance is light. They have always shed tears and supplicated to Him subhanahu wa ta'ala as if they were people who had committed the greatest sins. We have many narrations providing the insight into such a noble personality. One of them we will mention in the next program, inshallah. Anyway, one point remains to be mentioned regarding this verse. It is the point that Almighty Allah had told them whatever they needed before they are punished. The Almighty Allah does not punish the people without giving them a prior warning. The Almighty Allah had sent them the prophets had told them the truth and had invited them to the path of the Almighty Allah. But although they knew that the verses of the Quran were being recited to them, they turned their faces away. We will inshallah talk about these verses more in the next programs. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key. Unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran's deputy foreign minister for political affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK foreign ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed that the resistance in Lebanon has prevented full U.S. hegemony over Lebanon and has prevented civil war. Underlining the achievements of the resistance, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that one of the most tangible results is the fact that Israel is deterred from launching aggressions and even fears the strength of the resistance.
For the first time, Israel is living in a deeply rooted state of fear and concern for its existence. The elites in this entity are asking about the legitimacy of the entity's existence and the ability to exist. They are trying to get some oxygen through normalization of ties with some Arab states, but deep in their minds, the Israelis know that all these countries cannot protect their occupation or forts from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
Speaking at Hezbollah's Martyr Day celebration, Nasrallah said the main fear for the Israelis is that the resistance in Lebanon would invade the Galilee in northern occupied Palestine. Sayyid Nasrallah also criticized the Saudi campaign against Lebanon, saying a sovereign state would not accept any foreign dictates. The real problem is the crisis the Saudis have in Yemen, he said. The only way to stop it is to accept a ceasefire and lift the siege. Representatives of Lebanese political factions consider that the sacrifices of the martyrs of the resistance in Lebanon are evident for the entire region.
This is a historic day, not just for the resistance in Lebanon, but also for all the people from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Palestine. Had it not been for the martyrs, the entire region would have been destroyed. The Zionists and the Takfiris are the same, supported by the U.S. and Arab regimes. But we believe this sacred blood will liberate Palestine.
Families of the martyrs, for their part, stress that they would not back down.
The blood of our sons bore fruit, and we cannot back down now despite all the campaigns against us. Our children and grandchildren will continue to sacrifice their lives.
Sayyid Nasrallah also reiterated that as the resistance liberated Lebanon from Israeli occupation, their next goal is full sovereignty and freedom from U.S. hegemony.
What began with the first martyrdom operation in November 1982 as a fight for freedom from Israeli occupation in Lebanon has transformed into a struggle for emancipation for the entire region. And what used to be a grassroots resistance in a small Mediterranean country is now backed by an alliance on a regional scale, ready to face new U.S.-Israeli threats. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
This was the first visit by Afghan interim foreign minister to Pakistan. The fact Pakistan provided its plane to Amir Khan Muttaqi highlights the precarious economic situation the Afghan government is facing at the moment. Muttaqi met Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan, who assured all-out support to the people of Afghanistan in the wake of worsening humanitarian and economic crisis.
There are a number of issues which Pakistan and the Afghan government, especially the Taliban regime, they will be talking about, particularly engaging with the world. And you know, Taliban are ready to get engaged with the world.
The visit of the Afghan interim foreign minister was coincided with a meeting of top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States. Known as Trika Plus, the special envoys of these four countries discussed the current Afghan situation. They also met the Afghan interim foreign minister.
This was the first time that top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States together held talks with the Afghan interim foreign minister. Amir Khan Muttaqi was informed about the expectations of the international community from the Taliban government.
A joint statement issued by the Trika Plus reminded the Taliban of its promises they made with the international community. The Afghan foreign minister was told that the Taliban need to form more inclusive and representative government. At the same time, the Taliban government was reminded of its commitment to cut ties with all terrorist groups. But Pakistan, Russia, China, and the U.S. favor engagement with the Taliban government.
We believe Taliban are interested in engagement as they seek international acceptance and support. It is therefore crucial that the international community avoids repeating mistakes of the past and continues with positive engagement.
The four countries expressed deep concern over the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and promised to extend all possible help, while the U.S. has refused to unfreeze $9.5 billion Afghan central bank assets. But there is no indication if any of the country is willing to recognize the Taliban government yet. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces, CRPF, and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts. Last month, around a dozen civilians were killed. The presence of forces will therefore ensure a sense of security among the residents.
However, residents complain about the humiliating and disrespectful behavior of the security forces.
Authorities should accommodate or relocate the entire neighborhood. The presence of troops around our homes has made us gripped. Not only this, the usual frisking on roads is also disturbing our mental peace, and we are often being humiliated. The entire population is looked at through the prism of terrorism and terrorists.
Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone and the longest pending dispute. India and Pakistan have fought wars over the territory since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries rule the region in parts but claim it in full.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi promised equality to the people of Kashmir. Analysts say 2 years on, people of Kashmir have instead developed a deeper sense of insecurity and alienation. And so far, New Delhi has done least to address their grievances. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Another moment of pride for Iran at the United Nations for its active partnership since joining the world body in 1950. The country has now become a full member of the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession was approved by a unanimous vote at the Special Political Committee of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. UNSCEAR rarely expanded to include new members, but under the resolution proposed by Australia, four countries were admitted, raising the number to 31. Norway, Algeria, and the UAE were other nations who joined the body. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht Ravanchi, praised the General Assembly's decision to admit Iran into the committee. He expressed Tehran's full support for the body in its scientific endeavors to protect the planet and humans.
Iran reiterates its full support for and cooperation with the UNSCE in order to further enhance the infrastructure capacity and training of its personnel, as well as support nuclear safety, protect the public health and the environment from the harmful effects of atomic radiation.
Iran's accession is perceived as a major step forward since the top UN scientific body on nuclear safety has always been under Western influence. As expected, the decision faced stiff opposition from Israel and the U.S. Takht Ravanchi responded to anti-Iran allegations raised by Israel and the U.S. He said the track record of Tel Aviv and Washington show they are not in a position to oppose Iran's membership to the scientific committee. The Iranian envoy said that while the Israeli regime has flagrantly violated many UN resolutions and defied international efforts to contain weapons of mass destruction, Washington dishonored its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. A nuclear scientist has hailed Iran's accession to the committee as a very positive step.
In general, it's a good move for Iran. Iran can have send some of its scientists to the mission to join the work and the effort of this committee. I think at the end it will be a very positive step for Iran.
As Afghans witnessed their most difficult days, the 12th round of Iranian aid to Afghanistan arrived in Kabul. These batches, including 5 tons of medicines and 5 tons of food, are meant to treat injuries and be distributed to the families of victims of Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daoud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Iran's been sending a series of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan since the beginning of the recent crisis in the country, at the recommendation of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to help our brothers. This current shipment will target those who were injured and lost their beloved ones in the recent Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daoud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Taliban officials welcome emergency aid to the country and thank those who stay by the Afghan side in the darkest days. People suffering from poverty and difficulties await more help from the world countries.
We thank Iran for its humanitarian aid to our people. May God give them in return. Iranian aids have always been on time, especially when they helped us with emergency aid after 2 large mosque blasts. Today, our people in a critical situation and need help. So the world countries should help us and free our frozen assets.
The recent crisis largely affected our poor people. We don't have anything to eat or treat our patients. My brother is injured. Now he is under treatment here. Neither the hospital has enough medicines, nor do we have enough money to buy them from outside.
At least 25 people were killed and more than 50 wounded when Daesh terrorist gunmen attacked the 400-bed Sardar Mohammad Daoud Khan Hospital after 2 heavy explosions at the site in central Kabul. Daesh attacks come as hunger crises are looming in the country. Some countries, including Iran, have been sending shipment of aid. However, to address the problem of hunger in Afghanistan, more international assistance is needed. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Furious students gathered outside the London School of Economics on Tuesday to condemn the university after its debate society invited Israel's UK ambassador to speak at an evening event. The university claimed the event is meant to encourage discourse about the Middle East, but a large number of Muslim and pro-Palestine students are having none of it.
These students are not just angry at the fact that the Israeli ambassador is speaking here today, but they're also venting their frustrations at the university and the debate society as well. They say that by inviting the ambassador to speak here today, they've essentially platformed racism and Islamophobia.
Appointed in 2020, Israel's Zippy Hotovely has been condemned over past comments she made targeting Arabs and Islam. She once reportedly denied Palestine's existence and famously said the Nakba was a great Arab lie.
This is against what the student body wanted. For this university, all the students here are deeply ashamed. This university has failed to recognize and represent the student body.
Someone like this person doesn't really deserve the right to speak about them. She has made comments dehumanizing an entire people. If she can dehumanize people and invalidate their right to speak, why should she have any sort of right?
So she's actually a preacher, a hate preacher, legitimizing killing children, legitimizing destroying Palestinian hope, legitimizing the expansion of settlers, brutally destroying the crops and everything of the Palestinian.
We as the Jews, we feel obliged to stand up against this racist, against this fascist, and what she presents and who she presents. And we want to encourage the students to come out again in the open for justice, for peace.
Despite the backlash and a walkout staged by students inside the debate hall, the talk went ahead. The Palestinian ambassador will also speak, but at a separate event on the 11th of November. But that hasn't been enough to calm the students' anger.
Robert Carter, London.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment and custodial torture continue with impunity, while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem in Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over 7 decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Senior military commanders parade and salute army soldiers as the last phase of a 3-day maneuver codenamed Zulfaqar 1400. The military exercise engaged the 4 branches of the Iranian army and was held over a 1 million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Army commanders say the drill was a success and it carries regional and global messages.
The Islamic Republic has in recent years proved that it can be the axis of regional security, which entails a collective regional cooperation. If regional states join hands, they can protect the security of the region without the need to rely on foreigners. History has shown that foreign countries would never bring sustainable security to any nation.
The massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems. The Army also deployed its latest combat and reconnaissance drones, which are produced domestically. The Islamic Republic takes great pride in indigenizing its defense arsenal against the backdrop of an all-out sanctions regime by the U.S. that blocks Iran's access to even a bullet from other countries.
The Iranian army is prepared to confront any force that could possibly threaten Iran's territorial integrity and interests. Using our indigenous defense equipment, we are capable of defending our soil and will nip in the bud any threat from our enemies.
Situated in a geopolitically sensitive region, Iran holds regular drills as a means to enhance its preparedness in the face of possible threats, such as terrorism and piracy. Iran's armed forces have on different occasions underscored that the country will not be the first to pull the trigger, and its military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression.
The 3-day military exercise wrapped up with important messages. On top of them is that Iran is strongly opposed to any foreign presence in the regional waters, describing it as destabilizing and provocative. The Iranian army says it